So today I want to talk about classifying certain objects, and should start at the start with the projective space. So if we have a V vector space, for the moment we can work over any field because we're just doing algebraic geometry. Later we'll be working with the complex numbers and things. And we want to look at all the lines through the origin. So this is just the projective space on V. Everybody knows that's an algebraic variety, and you can identify it with, if you choose a basis, then you can identify it with the usual projective space PM by choosing a basis. So the next step is, again, we have a vector space over K, and the next step is to look at subspaces. So this is dimension n. We want to look at subspaces, dimension d less, some fixed d less than n. So we want, now, so we have the set of all these things, and we can make them into an algebraic variety as follows. If W is dimension D, then if you take the kth exterior power, dth exterior power over K of W, then that's sitting in, this is a line, this would be a line, one dimension, it's sitting inside the dth exterior power of V. So we get a map from the set of all W's to this point here, sitting inside our projective space of, and you can check that this is a closed subset. So it's an algebraic variety again. So more down-to-earth way of doing it is if we choose a basis for a fixed basis for V, then to give a subspace, you can choose a basis for that. And if you do that, then choosing a basis will give you each basis element, you have D basis elements, and each basis element is expressed in terms of the basis for V, so you get a D by D rows and N by N column matrix. And if I chose a different basis for W, I'm fixing the basis for V, if I chose a different basis for W, then I could multiply this on the left by some D by D matrix invertible. So if I look at the D by D minus, or the maximal size minus in here, the determinants of the D by D submatrices, if I look at all of them, then I get a point in some monster projective space. And if I multiply on the left by an invertible matrix, I just change all the minus by the determinant of this matrix here. So I get a well-defined point in projective space independent of the choice of the basis for W. So this is the elegant way of realizing the subspaces dimension D is a subvariety. This is the more down-to-earth way. Choose a basis for V, realize that a subspace of dimension D described by a D by N matrix up to a multiplication by that, and that gives you a point here by looking at the minors of the matrix. Now we want to study this a little more. So if I fix a subspace of complementary dimension, so dimension n minus d, then I can look inside this is called the Grassmannian. So the Grassmannian of d-dimensional subspaces of V. If I fix a subspace of the complementary dimension, and then I can look at the subspace of, turned out to be a subvariety of this, of all the subspaces such that they're transverse to S. So this is contained in here. And so let's fix one. Then I claim that if I take, so of course, V is decomposed now. This is a subspace of complementary dimensions, and the intersection is zero. So V is decomposed as a direct sum like this. Well, I claim that if I take any other thing in here, so if I take a W, a dimension D whose intersection with S is zero, then if I have the subspace of dimension D and V, and the intersection with this is zero, when I project from here to here, I get an isomorphism. Projecting from here to here will be an isomorphism. So what that tells you is that W is in fact the graph of a linear map from W0 to S. More precisely, if I want to know where, if I take a something here, there's a unique pair, let's call it W. There's a unique pair such that this lies in here. So if we fix an S and we fix a W, then we see that GD gets identified with just the homomorphisms from W0 to S, and we can rewrite that as Holmes from W0 to S over W0. V over W0. Right. So, of course, this is, if you do this in the projective space case, then this is just the usual way you of getting, breaking the projective space up as a union of affines. Now, the reason we're interested in, so this tells you that if you look at the subset of, this is D. Now everything's right, I hope. Look at the subset of the Grassmannian. It's just in a natural way, this vector space here. So in other words, it's just an affine space, affine space. Instead of being on K to the D, it's on K to the M or something, it's on this vector space. So this tells you, first of all, that the Grassmannian is not very interesting as a variety. It's just a union of these affine varieties. And what's interesting to us at the moment is that it tells us also what the tangent space is. You have a vector space, and you think of it as a variety, then the tangent space at any point is just the variety itself. So the tangent space at W0 to the Grassmannian, well, S doesn't matter. Is canonically isomorphic to Holm W0 and to V over W0. Okay. That's the key point. So, well, next step is to, instead of having one subspace, you have lots of subspaces, a sequence of subspaces. So again, we have a vector space of dimension n. And so I want to fix some integers, maybe this many. And then I consider, instead of just one subspace, I consider a sequence of subspaces. So descending sequence of subspaces. Should have written this the other way around. Where this has dimension dp and this has dimension d. dp plus No, I'm like, okay. So what we get now, so I want, so I fix V and I fix these numbers and I consider all the flags, these are called flags, change the subspaces with the same dimensions. And of course, this, so of course, if I only had one V, then this would just be the last case of the Grassmannian. So this is usually called a flag manifold, I'll just call it. Now D, with the underline, stands for this R2-pool of numbers. Now, of course, everything I said about Grassmannians extends to flag varieties. So in particular, this, is, in a natural way, is an algebraic variety. So there's an algebraic variety whose points are in a natural way. Points in the field K are just the flags. And it's a little bit more work, but you also get a nice description of the tangent space to the point on here. So make a guess, what should the... Well, of course, you get a map from this flag variety into the product of the Grassmannians for each of the corresponding D, just by sending the flag to the individual subspaces. And so the expected tangent space of the flag to look something like this. So suppose I fix the flag and I want the tangent space to the Grassmannian. What should it be? Well, we expect that it should consist of homomorphisms like that. So homomorphisms from here to V over FP, and then for FP plus 1, we should get another homomorphism here. And this is sitting inside here. So here we're dividing up by more, so there's a map like this. So the natural guess for the tangent space of the flag variety is simply consists of element maps like this, which make this diagram commute. And that's true. Okay, so the tangent space of a flag manifold, flag variety at a particular flag just consists of all the linear maps like this. So in other words, things in the tangent space to the Grassmannians, which are compatible in the sense that this commutes. And I should say that in the notes for this lecture, I get one of these arrows pointing in the wrong direction. So I should never give out notes before the lecture. Okay. So that's that. Well, now I want to go on to another type of thing. So I want to now talk about Hodge structures. So what I've been doing so far is algebraic geometry. Now we're definitely putting up with real numbers or the complex numbers. So let's take V to be a real vector space. And I think, as I already discussed a bit, this, by this I just mean C, the corresponding complex vector space. And of course, this has a complex conjugation. Or more down to earth terms, if you choose a basis for V, a real basis for V, then it will be a complex basis for VC, and then complex conjugation just acts on the coefficients of the of any coordinates of any element. So a Hodge structure So hot structure weighed in. Is a decomposition. All my vector spaces are finite, by the way. So you decompose this with the indices add up to n. And I want that the complex conjugate of this space is this with the numbers going the other way. So that's a Hodge structure. Eventually you want to try to classify Hodge structures. Hodge structure weighed in. So the example that I'm going to use a lot is, yeah, and the numbers that turn up, of course, only a finite number P's and Q's are going to turn up, and the P's and Q's that actually turn up are called the type of the Hodge structure. So if you have a Hodge structure of type 1, 0, 0, 1, then this is more or less the simplest, not quite trivial Hodge structure. So this means that you have a real vector space and you have a decomposition. Like this, and the complex conjugates. I claim that they're giving a giving a Hodge structure of this type is the same as giving a complex structure on V, because the map from V to, so these are complex subspaces of VC, and the map from here to this is an isomorphism. You have something in here, this complex conjugate is over here, so it can't be fixed under complex conjugation. There's nothing in here which is fixed under complex conjugation. It's nothing in here that's also in here. So this map is injective, and by coming to mention, it's an isomorphism. So from a Hodge structure like this, you get a complex structure on V. And in fact, you get a 1-1 correspondence between Hodge structures of type 1, 0, 0, 1, and complex structures on the real vector space. In this fashion. How do you go backwards if you have a complex structure on here, so a J square is minus 1, and you take this one to be the plus I. Opinions differ, but I'm taking that one to be the plus I eigenspace and the other one to be the minus I eigenspace. Now, if I take V to have dimension 2, then this becomes even easier. In this case, we just, we have VC is a vector space of dimension, complex vector space of dimension 2, and we're decomposing it as a line plus the complex conjugate of a line. So in this particular case, the Hodge structures of this type, well, the Hodge structures of this type on a vector space of dimension 2 are just lines such that this is the direct sum of it and its conjugate. Well, which lines in VC don't have this property? Well, the only way, either L intersect L bar is 0, in which case it does have this property, or L intersect L bar is L. In other words, L is equal to L bar. If L is equal to L bar, then it actually comes from a line in V itself. So in this case, the Hodge structures of this type, so this is only in dimension 2, otherwise it's a bit more complicated. They're just the points in the projective space of, so the non-real lines in the lines to the origin, I should say, non-real lines to the origin in here. Over. So if we choose a basis, this is equal to P2C minus P2R. And so you have the projective P1. Projective line over complex numbers minus the real line of the complex numbers. That, of course, is just C minus R. So it's the complex plane minus the real axis. So this maybe gives a hint of where we're heading. In this case, the Hodge structures of this type on a vector space of this dimension, in a natural way, they parameterize by the upper half plane and the lower half plane. So that's two Hermitian symmetric domains. Well, we want to do a little better, and we want to try and put some extra structure and try to get some things which are parameterized by just one connected Hermitian symmetric domain, just by the upper half plane itself. And then we want to try and generalize that so we get all Hermitian symmetric domains as parameterizing Hodge structures of certain types. So I have some definitions, if I don't need this anymore. So I need to, the next thing I need is what I'll call the Weil operator. I should probably have. So if I have a Hodge structure, a real Hodge structure, so I'm always fixing the weight, so this is weight n. And the Weil operator just acts as I to the q minus p on here. So if I, I claim that C commutes with complex conjugation on here. Maybe I can try and prove that. So if I take something in X in the PQ component over here and I apply, if I take the conjugate of that, then that's right, at least symbolically, that'll be something in the QP component. So that's I to the P minus Q. By definition, the operator C. And that, of course, is just, I take the complex conjugate of that, that's just I to the Q minus P, which is the complex conjugate of. Right. So it commutes with a complex conjugation. So in other words, C is really, so in particular, it takes things fixed by complex conjugation into themselves. So C is really an operator from V to V. And we describe it nicely on VC. And also, if you take C squared, then that acts as I to the 2q minus 2p. If we add 4p, it's harmless because I to the fourth is 1. Then this is I to the 2p plus 2q, which is I to the 2n, which is minus 1 to the n. So we see that this Bay operator acts as plus 1 or minus 1, depending upon whether these are plus 1 or minus, even or odd dimensional, even or odd weight. Okay, that's the Bay operator. So the next thing I need is the notion of a Hodge tensor. So I just want this in a trying to make a down-to-earth fashion. So we have a V in a Hodge structure. So I just want to consider tensors of the following form. So I'll think of them as multilinear. Mass like this. And to be a Hodge tensor, they have to satisfy the following condition. That if I apply them to this is equal to 0 unless the p's add up to the same as the q's. So another way of looking at this, well, there's many ways of looking at it, but one way of looking at it is that, for example, if you only have two components, this only decomposes two components, and this is really a multilinear form on sort of the complementary. Yeah, for example, if you have V1, 0 plus V0, 1. And if you take two things in this bit here, then the pairing is 0 on them. So it's really a pairing between this and this. It's not really a pairing between V and itself. And I claim that if you, so this is a Hodge tensor. We call this a Hodge tensor. I claim that if you have a Hodge tensor, then and you apply the C operator, then you get this. Well, let's check that. So. So the what? This is the Bay operator. No. All I'm saying is that if we have a tensor and it satisfies this condition, then we call it a Hodge tensor. Well, of course, there'll be zillions of Hodge tensors. More than zillions. Okay, so the point is that this decomposes. So we want to check something like this. We only have to check it for taking, well, everything in VC is the direct sum of things in these things here. So we just have to check it on elements. So for we can take this to be a V P1 Q1 sort of type. In the P1, Q1 bit, and so on. So these are complex subspaces, so when I apply C to them, they'll be preserved by the complex subspace. The type will be preserved, the type of the elements. And now, so this thing on the left here will be 0, unless we have this condition here. And if we have this condition here, then the PIs add up to the same number as the QIs, and we define C to be Q, I to the Q minus P, so the Qs add up to the same. Well, we get this taken out from each factor, and they add up to zero. Okay. So if you have a Hodge tensor, then it's invariant under the action of the V operator. Okay. So the next thing we need is the polarization of a Hodge structure. I mean, maybe I'll get my notes. So what do I want? Yeah, so again, these are the real vector space with a Hodge decomposition. And what I want is, so I want to define the notion of a polarization. So this will be a bilinear form. And we want it to be a Hodge tensor. So that implies that it's like that. And we want that this is a positive, we want this to be a symmetric positive definite form. Well, what I really mean, you get a new form by sending U and new pairing by sending U and V and V to psi of U CV, and I want this to be symmetric and positive definite. Okay. So that's the call of polarization. And what does it mean? Well, let's just take a look and see what it tells us about whether the symmetry or non-symmetry of psi. Well, this, if we change the order around, what happens to psi if psi is a polarization? Well, because it's a Hodge tensor, this is equal to CV CU. Now, this thing here is symmetric. So in other words, if I define psi of C UV to be equal to psi of U CV, this is symmetric. So if you apply this, then with thinking of this over here, then I claim what you get is a U here and a C squared V here. Okay, so the symmetry of this form here tells us that this is equal to this. And C squared, we decided, was minus 1 to the n, where n is the weight of the Hodge structure. So this is tells us that, this is equal to psi uv if n is even, and it's equal to minus psi uv, n is odd. I'm more interested in the odd case somehow. So skew symmetric if you have odd weight and it's symmetric itself if it's even. So I left this up here. In this particular case, to have a polarization just means you have these. So we decided that Hodge structures of this form correspond to complex structures. I should have mentioned back here, I'm supposed to be carrying this example all the way through, but if we go back here, if you have the V operator in this case here, just the J. I hope. So in this particular case, if you have a Hodge structure of this type here, what does it mean to have a polarization? I claim it just means the following two things. This is positive definite symmetric. Some of you, I hope, probably some of you know all this stuff anyway, but this might look familiar to people who know about abelian varieties, that this is more or less a Riemann form, except that you require a Riemann form to be integral or something, but these are the conditions to be a Riemann form. And that, of course, is, in other words, a Riemann form polarizes a complex torus. And this is why we call this a polarization. It's a generalization of that notion. Okay. Okay, so let's get back to a two-dimensional case. Suppose we take B to be dimension 2, and we want to look at the Hodge structures, again, of type 1, 0, 0, 1. So they're just one-dimensional subspaces. They're not real. Now, so what's the polarization in this case? Well, in this case, the weight's odd. Weight's 1. So we're looking for a skew symmetric form. Well, there are not too many skew symmetric forms on a two-dimensional vector space. We want a non-degenerate skew symmetric form. You don't have to require psi to be non-degenerate because it turns out, of course, that if it was degenerate, this couldn't be positive definite. So the form is certainly non-degenerate. So if you have one non-degenerate, of course, the point is that this is just equal to R, isomorphic to R. So if you have one skew symmetric form, then every other skew symmetric form on V is a non-zero multiple of it. So it's not true they're all the same. In fact, the non-degenerate skew symmetric forms on a real two-dimensional vector space pull into two components. You take one and then you can multiply it by a positive number, or you can multiply it by a negative number. So, in other words, in a sense, the skew symmetric, non-degenerate skew symmetric forms form a real line with the origin removed. So that's I guess I don't think I'll do that. I think I'll leave it as an exercise for you to work out what happens. But I claim what happens is that if you look at the Hodge decompositions, then they fall into two classes, either either psi is a polarization. So you take a Hodge structure of this type on V, then either psi is a polarization or minus psi is a polarization. One or the other, of course, but not both. So once you fix a psi, then the psi for which the Hodge structures for which psi is a polarization now form one kinetic component of the, well, we saw that the Hodge structures of this type fell into two kinetic components, the upper half plane and the lower half plane, once we chose a basis for V. And you can distinguish them by, once you fix the psi, then you can distinguish them. So another what I'm claiming is that if we, once we fix the psi, then the Hodge structures on here for which psi is a polarization form an upper half plane. They form a connected Hermitian symmetric domain. Okay. So now you can guess where I'm going. So I want to now realize all Hermitian symmetric domains in this fashion as parameterizing Hodge structures with some stuff. So I need some definitions. Somehow I have avoided so far talking about the Hodge filtration. So far, I've just been talking about Hodge structures. I don't have any. In this case, we put some extra structure on them because we saw that they corresponded to points in the projective line. Otherwise, we just have Hodge structures. Now we want to somehow see how to parameterize Hodge structures. We want to know how when two Hodge structures are close together, for example. So we should look at the Hodge filtration. So if I have a Hodge structure then the Hodge filtration is defined by so it's a decreasing filtration, like I started off with. Yeah, so I think to make sure I get to the end of the talk, I'll let you calculate that. So what happens when we take the complex conjugate? Well, obviously, we can work that all out. And you find that FP plus F, this is a simple exercise, so the direct sum of these two is V. So this gives you all the VRS is, this is VC, I should say. So this is called the, so this gives you all the components here with R greater than or equal to P. And if you work this one out, you find that it gives you all the components with R less than P. So you get this direct sum here. And so given a Hodge decomposition, a Hodge structure like this, you get that. And given a filtration, a descending filtration with this property here, you can go backwards as well. So what you do is you define VPQ equal to FP intersect FP FQ bar. Where P plus Q is equal to M. Is that right? Yeah. So from a Hodge decomposition, you get a filtration, and the filtration determines the, certainly determines the Hodge structure. Okay. Well, that's nice because given a Hodge structure, we get a filtration on a vector space, and given a filtration on a vector space, we get a point in a flag manifold. So the question is, what sort of subset of the flag manifold do we get by looking at Hodge structures of certain types? Now what I want to do is, so I want to fix V once and for all, and I want to consider Hodge structures just on V itself. And I want S to be a connected complex manifold. And suppose that I have a Hodge structure of weight n depending upon S. So I have a family of Hodge structures on my fixed vector space V parameterized by S. Now the question is, when is that going to be a nice family in some sense? So we'll say that it's continuous somehow we want a notion of when does, so for every point of S and S we have this decomposition. We want to know when does that decomposition vary continuously. What does that mean? Well, in terms of Grassmannians, we can say that. So certainly want that the, since we're on a connected manifold, we certainly want these integers to be the same. So this is the dimension of VPQ. We want that to be constant. And so we get a map from, so for each P and Q, we get a map from S, from sending S to, well, we get a map from S to the Grassmannian. So VC. So it sends a point. So it sends the point to. So the nice thing about Grassmannian is they give us a formal way of saying when two subspaces of a vector space are close together, for example. So they will say that this is a continuous family of Hodge structures parameterized by S. If these Hodge numbers are all constant, and the map from here to here is continuous. Fine. And we'll say it's holomorphic. If the map to the Hodge, if it's continuous and the map sending S to the Hodge filtration is holomorphic. When I talked about Grassmannians, I talked about them as algebraic varieties, but of course they're certainly smooth. If you do them over, work over the complex numbers, they're certainly smooth complex manifolds. So the D, of course, so we would define DP to be equal to the set of sigma D PQ DRS R greater than or equal to P. It's the right number, whatever. So we'll say that the family's continuous. You might ask why we do this. Well, they're the ones that turn up, and it's the right definition. You might ask, why don't we require that one to be holomorphic. That would be too strong a condition to require this to be holomorphic. Now, if you look at this one here, then we get a. So we get, in other words, we get a holomorphic map from here to. So if we have a holomorphic family of Hodge structures, gives us a holomorphic map from here to the. The flag manifold, and we went to a great deal of trouble to work out the. Tangent space, so I have a point here. So this is a holomorphic map, so we get a map from the holomorphic tangent space to the holomorphic tangent space here, which is the same as the one given by algebraic geometry. So tangent space here, let's call this C. And remember, this was okay. This is something in here. It was compatible families of maps like this. Now, the last definition we need is that we'll call this a variation of Hodge structures. F. Well, instead of, if the image of this map lies inside the image This is DC. The image of DC lies inside the direct sum of HOM FP. Well, not in the whole thing, but FP minus 1 over FP. Okay, so it's only a little bit of that. It has to go into a little bit. That's a curious condition, but this is originally recognized by Griffith as a good condition, and I haven't mentioned, but these things turn up in algebraic geometry. If you have a smooth family of projective varieties over a complex variety, and you look at you get on every fiber, you get cohomology groups. They all have Hodge structures. It goes back to Hodge, and Griffith proved that they have all these properties here. So these are the properties of families of Hodge structures that turn up in nature. The only thing is here, I'm considering Hodge structures on a fixed vector space, and the ones that turn up in nature, the V is also varying. Okay. So now I'm still fixing my V, and I also want to fix some tensors. So let T be a family of tensors. Say R, where T0 is just a non-degenerate form. And I fix that. So what I'm going to do is, I'll do it, and then we'll see what we've done. So I also want to consider families of Hodge structures of a certain type. And so I have to fix some data. So I consider, if I fix a function, so I fix a family of tensors just for V for the moment. And some functions that are going to be the DPQs for our family. So there's some obvious condition. dpq has to equal 0 for almost all pq. And dpq has to equal dqp. And maybe d plus dpq. I don't know. Maybe I need some other condition, but it doesn't matter. So now, negative what? The p's and q's can be negative. These are the dimensions of the supposed to be the dimensions of the various components. P's and q's are. P's and q's can be any integers. So what I do is I let, so given this and this function, I let this be the set of all Hodge decompositions. So I can set everything of this type, Hodge decompositions, such that the dimension of dpq is equal to, is fixed. And I want that the p's belong to p are going to be Hodge tensors. And I want that p0 is a polarization. So I just, over here, I fix the vector space V. I fix some tensors up for the vector space. And I fix some integers. And I want to consider all the Hodge structures, that the dimensions of the components of these, the p's are Hodge tensors, and p0 is a polarization. This is the last thing. So I want the weight to be fixed. So this is pq is equal to 0 for p. Plus q not equal to n. Right. So I fixed everything that ought to be fixed. Now, certainly we can consider this, all these things are sitting inside some product of Grassmannians for the dpqs. So unfortunately I have to take a connected component. So in other words, given all these things here, I get a point in a product of Grassmannians for the dpqs, and I just take, so I have the notion of things being close. So I have a topology on the set of all these things, and I take a connected some connected component. So now I can state the theorem. So the theorem is there's a unique complex structure on the set of Hodge structures of this type. Unique complex structure such that for which this is a holomorphic family. So you can make the set of these things, think of this as the set of these things, you can make this into a complex manifold in exactly one way, so that every point here we have a Hodge structure and it satisfies this definition here. There's only one way to make the set of Hodge structures into a complex manifold, so that tautologically the tautological family is holomorphic family, satisfies that condition. Here's the amazing thing. This is Hermitian symmetric domain. If and only if you get a variation of odd structures. And the third thing is that all Hermitian symmetric domains arise in this way. So we have a new way of thinking of Hermitian symmetric domains, which is very beautiful. They're the complex manifolds that parameterize certain families of Hodge structures. So this theorem is not all that hard to prove. It's sketched in the notes. I think this observation is due to Dalin Hermitian symmetric domains can all be thought arise in this, exactly in this fashion. So this Griffith's transversality condition over here turns up precisely as over here is giving us a Hermitian symmetric domain rather than some other just complex space. So about the proof. Well, the proof said that there's a unique complex structure. We have a map from here into the Grassmannian. The key point is just to show that the image of the tangents, that the you get a complex structure on the image of, well, you can realize this as a homogeneous space, and then you get a map into the Grassmannian, and the key point is just to show that the image of the tangent space of the real is actually complex, and that's just a calculation. And this one here is none of this is too difficult, so I just stop there.